Well, hey, everybody. It is great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online. And before I get going with what I want to talk to you about today, kind of a big week in my family. May the 4th be with you. There you go. Star Wars fans, if you're not, you're like, huh? And you're like, I like Star Trek. We don't have a day for you. Sorry. Anyway, Rand, we're working on it. Anyway, May 1st was the day that high school seniors basically had to sign up for their college of choice. And my eldest is a senior this year, and he's not with us because he had prom last night. But in order to tell me his selection, and this is an answer for prayers for some of you, he gave me this, okay? Yeah, I know. Yep. So I called my counselor, okay? And he said, baby steps. He goes, appreciate it. Put it in your office. Don't wear it yet. Just pace yourself. And I said, that's probably good advice. Baby, I'm super proud of him and super excited. And now I'm a Michigan State fan too, so watch out. I'm just saying. All right. We are in the second week of a series called Letting Go and Moving Forward. It's all about letting go of the things that are weighing you down and moving forward into the life that God has for you. And as many of you know, last week we began this series by asking a really interesting and really important question. Namely, why doesn't everyone who attends church regularly end up looking like Jesus? Because if we're being honest, they don't, right? I mean, we all have friends who have been in church for years, and you can tell, right? They're more patient and generous and loving and gracious and kind than they were before they committed to regular church attendance. Studying Jesus has made their life better, and studying Jesus has made them better at life. So that's awesome. But we also have friends who have attended church for just as long, and they've heard the same talks, and they've sat through the same songs, and in the same small groups, but like following Jesus just doesn't really seem to have made that much of a difference in their lives. In many ways, then, this series is my attempt to answer the question, why? And as I mentioned last week when we were together, I'm more convinced than ever that it has to do with what the authors of the Bible call the heart. And they describe the heart as this invisible, intangible thing that really drives our lives. And they identify it as the source of what we say and what we do. Instead of the thing that pumps blood through our bodies, they're talking about our emotional center. And as it turns out, they tell us it's absolutely critical that we learn how to keep it clean and healthy. So just give you one example. There's a warning that was written by Israel's King Solomon. He lived about 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. And his wisdom was collected in a book called Proverbs that was later included in our Old Testament, rather. And here's what Solomon says. He says, above all else, in other words, you know, I've just given you a ton of wisdom about all sorts of different things, but above all else, priority number one, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. So Solomon would say, literally, the single most important thing that you or I can do to help us live the life that God has for us is to guard our hearts. And that's pretty amazing if you think about it, because growing up, most of us weren't taught how to do that. We were taught to monitor our behavior. Like, we learned what to say to get a date, and how to keep a job, and we learned what not to say if we didn't want to get in a bunch of trouble. But no one ever taught us how to monitor our hearts. And as it turns out, that's a really big deal, because if we don't, we will eventually say things and do things that we shouldn't. And when we do, we'll inevitably think to ourselves, like, where did that come from? And Solomon would cry throughout the generations, it came from your heart. And that's why it's so critical that you learn to guard it. And that's really what this series is all about. Like, for the 4 weeks leading up to Memorial Weekend, we're getting painfully specific about four different things that, if they get lodged in your heart, may keep you from letting go and moving forward into the sort of life that Jesus intends for you. Four things that have the potential to do incredible damage to your health, your happiness, your relationships, and your ability to thrive. And the four things are guilt and jealousy and anger and greed. And we're kind of taking them in this order. And someone on our programming team said to me this week, did you mean to talk about anger on Mother's Day? shouldn't you talk about love and flowers and something? And I was like, you know, next year, love and flowers. This year, anyway, that's just what came up in the list. But yeah, so last week we talked about guilt. Make sure your mom comes, it'll be great. Anyway, last week we talked about guilt, and we said that guilt is that little voice inside of you that rises up from time to time when you're with someone who you've hurt and whispers to you, I owe them. Like, I hurt them, I cheated on them, I abandoned them, I let them down, and now at some level, I owe them. So we talked about that last week, and we also talked about how confession can break the power of guilt. And therefore, confession is one of the best habits you can develop in order to guard your heart and keep it healthy. And by the way, if you missed that talk, you can catch up anytime on the website. It is well worth the time you'll have to spend. Anyway, today we get to talk about jealousy. And I want to begin with the observation that jealousy is kind of tricky for us to discuss because we tend to identify it as a struggle for kids, right? I mean, I think back to when I was 10 years old, and back then someone had a boombox that was way cooler than mine. Okay, I found this picture online. Friends, this is at a Kmart. Thank you very much, right? This is apparently some sort of boombox convention. People were trying it. And I had somebody come up after first service who's like, well, how did you stream from your phone to this? And I was like, we did not have Bluetooth. We had 8-track. That's right. Okay. Anyway, we think back, someone had a better boombox than we did. I was super jealous of them. And here's the thing. I think we can easily admit that sort of thing. But like in my experience, once we enter high school, we really don't like to admit when we're jealous. Like, we'll admit to being angry, we'll admit to feeling guilty, but we don't want to admit to feeling jealous because we tend to think that people will just tell us to grow up and get over it. And so most of us have a tendency to deny feelings of jealousy to the detriment of our heart. See, but if we're being honest, we all deal with jealousy. And I was thinking about this, like, I think I can prove it to you. So right now, somewhere in your life, there is someone who you don't like. And if you were pressed to say why, you'd eventually figure out that it's because they have something that you don't. Like, they haven't worked as hard as you have, but for some reason they've achieved more than you have. And you think that your natural response is just to dislike them, but what's really going on deep down is that you're jealous of them. And if that's going on, here's something else. The closer that you get to them, the worse you feel about you. And so that's why for so many of us, we just try to ignore feelings of jealousy by ignoring the people who make us feel jealous. And if they happen to come up in conversation with someone else, we tend to try to kind of cut them down a little bit. We're like, well, you know, he's just ridiculously nice, or she's just too pretty for her own good, or he's just way too smart. And that's a way to sort of deal with our feelings. But again, what's really going on is that the person that we're attempting to take down a notch with our words simply reflects something that we aren't and desire to be. So that's one way I think we cope with jealousy. But there's another way too. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but you kind of say to yourself, it's just not fair. Like, you see something, you're like, man, that's just not fair. My husband works just as hard as her husband does. Like, our kids study just as hard as their kids do. Why did they get into that school? Why did they get to go on that vacation? I mean, I saw online they're going to Toledo. I've always wanted to see Toledo in the spring. It's just not fair. And if you're from Toledo, save your emails. It's very hard to pick jokes like that. And I like Toledo. The zoo is great. Go team. Okay, anyway. But here's the thing. You see, it's just not fair. That's what we like to say. But here's what's so fascinating. You don't really want things to be fair. Because for things to truly be fair, all of the talent and beauty and health and resources in the whole world would have to be evenly distributed to every single person. And if that happened, like, every single one of us would take a few steps backwards. And so I would argue that when we're feeling jealous of someone, we don't want fair. We want more, right? Like, we want to be where they are. We want to drive what they drive. We want to wear what they wear. And we want to attribute what we're feeling to a lack of fairness. But again, we don't want fair. We want more. And that's why jealousy then isn't really a circumstance thing, although we think that it is. It's a heart thing. I mean, think about this. If you suddenly got the car of your dreams or you could fit into the clothes that you wanted to wear, you'd still experience jealousy. It would just be of someone else. You'd just look a little higher up the social ladder. And let's be honest, there's always someone a little higher up the social ladder, right? There's always someone who makes more money or who has more accomplished kids. And so even if we were to suddenly get what we wish we had, it wouldn't alleviate feelings of jealousy. It would simply cause the object of our jealousy to shift. Because jealousy is a heart issue. Okay, so now let me take this a level deeper. I want to talk to you about how to deal with jealousy, because fortunately for you, I've pretty much mastered it. Just kidding. Jealousy is an ongoing thing for all of us. It's a you need to guard your heart thing. But I would argue our challenge when it comes to jealousy is that we tend to think that they are our problem. And if we can distance ourselves from them, we'll distance ourselves from our problem. But they are not our problem because they cannot solve our problem. In fact, the only thing they can do that might help us is to fail. And that's just kind of weird. But that's why when we hear someone of whom we're jealous and that their business is struggling, we somehow feel better about ourselves. And then, you know, on the outside, we might say to them, oh, I'm so sorry. But deep down, we kind of celebrate the struggle. And then if you're paying attention, you're like, wait a minute, what is wrong with me? Like, where did that come from? Solomon would say it came from your heart. And so I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I've actually come to believe that another reason that it's wrong to blame the people of whom we're jealous for how we feel is that jealousy isn't really a problem between us and another person. It's a problem between us and God. I think there's a sense in which jealousy is our natural emotional response to the thought that God owes me. Like he owes me a different body or more wealth or more opportunities or a higher IQ or better parents or more compliant kids. He owes me. And so jealousy really has nothing to do with athletic people or rich people. Our problem is really with our Creator. Like deep down, we feel like he has ripped us off. But here's something we really need to think about if we're going to guard our hearts against jealousy. God has never claimed to be fair. Like, he really hasn't. He has claimed to have created each life on purpose and to have distributed gifts and talents and skills in a way that empowers each individual to achieve that purpose. But like, if my experience is any indication, people who fail to come to peace with this reality often face challenges in their faith, because honestly, how can you trust a God who you quietly suspect has ripped you off? So this has been a problem for a very long time for people, and so it really shouldn't surprise us that this conversation surfaces in those accounts of Jesus' life. In fact, 2,000 years ago, Jesus told a story to his first followers that can help us sort of see this God is not fair thing from heaven's perspective. And fortunately for us, it was recorded by a man named Matthew who would have heard it firsthand. And so in Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, that's the first book in your New Testament, Matthew tells us that one day Jesus starts telling this story, and as he begins, he described a scene that would have been familiar to his original audience, not so much to us, but it was this vision of a town square early one morning as the sun is rising, where a group of men had assembled hoping to be hired to work for the day. And so Jesus set it up this way. He starts with, for the kingdom of heaven is like, in other words, if you want to understand this from heaven's perspective, how things are working in God's kingdom, the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. And he goes on. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. Now, it's important for us to know that a denarius was an average day's wage at the time. And so this would have been seen by these guys as a fair proposition. And so they were thankful for the opportunity. They immediately went to work in the field. So just imagine this with me. The first 3 hours of the workday, roughly 6 to 9 a.m., were often pleasant for agricultural workers in first century Israel because the morning dew kept the dust at bay and the UV index, which wasn't a thing yet, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Wasn't yet a cause for concern. And Jesus continued. About the third hour, so we're talking like 9 a.m., the landowner went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. And he told them, "You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. And it's important to note that at this point, 25% of the workday has elapsed. Nonetheless, the landowner goes back to town, found some more guys, promised to pay them, and again, this is key, whatever is right. And they accept the invitation, join the others in the field, and Jesus continues. He went out again at the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same thing. So imagine if you're one of the guys who is working a 12-hour shift. I mean, you would be surprised to see a new crop of dudes arrive throughout the day every 3 hours. And then you'd be really surprised when 1 hour before quitting time, when your clothes are covered in dust and your hands are sore from working with the grapes, you notice the landowners wandering off towards town again. Jesus described it this way. About the 11th hour, the landowner went out and found still others standing around. And he asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day long and doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. And he said to them, "You also go work in my vineyard." So apparently there's this group of guys who'd been there since the sun came up, looking to be hired to provide something for their family. And they were beginning to suspect that they were going to have to return home empty-handed. But fortunately, this guy shows up, and they get to join the guys who've been working 11 hours and 9 hours and 7 hours and 5 hours and 3 hours. And then Jesus continued. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages." But this is interesting. "Beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." And so the sweaty, smelly, really tired guys are at the back of the line. The guys who've just arrived are at the front of the line. And as the guys in the back are sort of watching with anticipation, the landowner does something unexpected. Here's what Jesus said. "The workers who were hired about the 11th hour came and each received a denarius." Now, how much was that again? Right, the average wage for someone working a 12-hour shift. And I'm telling you, if I were standing in the back of the line, I would get very excited, right? Because, in fact, I'd be like, man, if they get a denarius, I probably get like a billion denariuses or something like that, right? I would start spending the money that I don't even have yet. If I could text my wife, I'd be like, this is going to be a good night, right? So how much will I get? And Jesus continued. "So when those who were hired first came, they expected to receive more." Of course they did. "But each one of them also received a denarius." Houston, we have a problem, right? I mean, all of a sudden, they're like talking about forming a union. Like, no one's going to work for this guy ever again. We're going on strike. And Jesus said, "When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. These men who were hired last worked only one stinking hour." That's in the Greek, not in the English, right? "And you've made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. What in the world is going on?" You can almost hear them cry out, can't you? "This isn't fair." Well, Jesus is obviously telling the story. He's setting up his disciples, but he described it in response to the protest. The landowner pulled one of the guys aside, one of the guys who'd been working all day, and he said this, "Friend, I'm not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius?" In other words, didn't I keep my promise to you? I mean, come back with me, 6 a.m. Didn't you agree this morning to come work in my fields for a denarius for 12 hours? Did I rip you off? He continued, "Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious?" And it's the same Greek word, jealous. "Are you jealous or envious because I am
generous. And here's what's some fun about Jesus. The story just ends. I just imagine the disciples sitting there going, he did it again. We have no idea what he's doing. This makes no sense, right? This is a strange story. Or maybe it's not. I mean, remember, Jesus told this story to his followers to help them understand something from heaven's perspective, something about how to navigate life in a world where things are simply not fair, a world in which it's tempting to feel like God has ripped you off. But if you think about it, as Jesus presents the story, the problem isn't that the landowner gave the guy who worked all day too little. It's that he gave the guys who worked only an hour too much. At least that's what it feels like from our perspective. But I think what Jesus is driving after here is the problem of living by comparisons. And this is such an easy thing to do in our world. This was easy before the internet and social media. Now it's almost impossible to avoid it because we're so aware of what everyone in our social circle is up to. Living by comparisons is probably one of the single greatest threats to the health of our hearts in our world today. Well, years ago, while I was working as a youth pastor here in town, my senior pastor, a rather smooth operator named Jeffrey Wayne Mannion, notice the picture, okay? He gave an illustration on this topic that has never left me. I probably have heard him teach 1,000 messages, and this is one of the images that just haunts me in wonderful ways. And so what I want to do is share with you what he shared with us back then. Again, the danger of living by comparison. So here's what he set it up this way. He said, just imagine with me there's a dad who had 2 sons who were jumping on a trampoline. And for obvious reasons, as a father of 4 boys, this was not hard for me to visualize. We've had multiple trampolines over the years and many trips to the ER because of, you know, broken things. But anyway, he said, imagine it's summer, it's hot, the 2 boys are jumping on the trampoline, and the dad's in the kitchen kind of getting ready, cleaning things up, getting ready for dinner. He thinks, you know what? It's snack time. I just want to bless my kids with some ice cream. Like, it's unexpected. They'll love it. And so he calls his older son in, and he grabs a bowl. And into this bowl, he places a huge scoop of ice cream. And again, this is an unexpected blessing. The kid just, the grin, ear to ear. He's so excited. And the dad says, hey, go send your younger brother in. And the kid walks out, and he's just like, Dad. He's like, he's the best dad I've ever had. Yeah, like this. And the younger son gets excited. He runs in. He goes up to dad, and dad gives him 2 scoops of ice cream. Same thing. You're the best dad I ever had. The younger son walks out like, oh, right? And he walks out, and the younger brother, he's sitting on the trampoline enjoying the ice cream, grin on his face, until he sees his younger brother's bowl. And in a moment, everything changes, right? Because he, the older brother, felt ripped off, even though moments before he had been thrilled. And I remember, I was thinking about the illustration, and years ago Jeff goes, I am just so glad this sort of thing disappears once we enter childhood, or exit childhood, aren't you? I mean, no, this never happens. No, we totally still do this, right? We're just better at hiding it. I mean, just imagine with me that you have just moved in to your dream home. And it's like perfect. I mean, you had saved, you had planned. It's absolutely perfect. You can't, every time you walk in, you're like, I can't believe I get to live here. I really couldn't be any happier. Until the night a few weeks later, when your friends who also had built a new home invite you over for dinner. And you're excited to see the project. And so you walk in, and the first thing you notice is that it's bigger, much bigger, right? And it's actually better. It's got more stuff than your house. It even has a tortilla chip warming drawer in the kitchen, like the ones at Qdoba. And you didn't even know that was possible. But you're like, could we add one of those to my kitchen? Anyway, all right. So after dinner, imagine you get back into the same car to return to your dream home. But now as you're pulling up, you feel ripped off. And you find yourself thinking, God, why aren't you fair? But I think what Jesus would argue is that what's really going on is that you took your eyes off of what was in your ice cream bowl in order to focus on and then obsess about what was in someone else's. And just speaking from my own story, I mean, when I keep my focus on what's in my bowl, life's good. But when I start to focus on and then obsess about what's in other people's bowls, people who have something that I want and can easily convince myself that I need, jealousy rises in my heart. And it's not good for me, and it's not good for the people around me. And again, this is a challenge today because the world in which we live, we can always find someone who has more in their ice cream bowl than we do. I mean, our awareness has gone through the roof. And God still does not seem particularly interested in resolving these inequalities. And so I would argue, as Jesus finished telling the story and the disciples were sitting there trying to figure out what he was trying to tell them, I think they had clarity on one thing. There was a question hanging in the air as Jesus finished the story. The question is simply this. Will you trust a God who isn't fair? And I think Jesus wants them to wrestle this down because he knows the reality is they will come to know God on these terms or not at all. Because again, the world in which we live, gifts and resources are not equally distributed. And Jesus would say that's because there is a different purpose for different lives. Equal value, different purpose. And so that established, I want to get super practical for a minute. Because like, okay, maybe this works for you. And you're like, okay, yeah, I totally do that. How do I guard my heart against jealousy? Like, I don't feel like I choose jealousy. I feel like it chooses me. So how do I do this? And based on conversations that I've had along these lines over the years, I just have two simple suggestions. And the first one goes like this. Whenever jealousy rises, acknowledge that your problem is not with the other person, it's with God. Like deep down, you, me, we, at times come to believe that God has ripped us off. And I know the idea of like confessing that to God feels awkward, but I'm telling you, when you have the guts to tell God how you really feel, healing begins. Plus, he can handle it. I mean, he's actually looking forward to your confession because he knows how much it will help you. He already knows what you're feeling anyway. So that's the first suggestion, pretty simple. You feel jealousy rise, just begin to pray and just make that confession to God. The second one I think is even more practical. You need to learn to celebrate what God has placed in your bowl and not to obsess about your sister-in-law's bowl or your neighbor's bowl or your coworker's bowl. Celebrate what's in your bowl. And just in case you're wondering, like, what is in my bowl? I just had a couple of thoughts to get you started, and this will be like the homework assignment. I won't check, but you should totally do this. Like, you know, exercise, like, what is in my bowl? What are the things I'm thankful for? In my job, I visit a lot of people who are struggling with their health. And so the first thing that I always think about in my bowl is my physical health. And I think to myself, I'm so thankful that I can enjoy dinner with some friends and then digest it successfully, right? And I know you're like, doesn't everybody do that? No, it doesn't always work like it should. And so we should never take that for granted, the ability to enjoy a meal, especially a meal with good friends, and then to have it processed successfully. So I start there, and then I think about, you know, the ability to meet a friend for a great cup of coffee early in the morning while the city comes to life around us and just talk about what God has been doing in our lives. That is a blessing, and it's something I never want to take for granted. Or it's the freedom to get in your car, or Mike, whatever, drive out to the beach, watch a sunset, go a little early, take a book, look at the water, watch the waves, take in the beauty of creation. That's one of the things that I reflect is in my bowl, something that I am so, so thankful for. And if you spend 5 minutes even doing this, you're going to go, man, there is a lot in my bowl. I'm really blessed. And the habit of reminding yourself of these blessings. Learn to acknowledge the things that you quickly take for granted. Learn what's in your bowl. It's a powerful thing to do. It's a powerful habit to initiate. Because, and I've seen this over and over again, thankfulness really can break the power of jealousy, and it can help you guard your heart. So for your homework, maybe over lunch, maybe over dinner, maybe by yourself later this afternoon, just think about what is in my bowl and then thank God for it and see what happens. I believe you'll find it's another step to letting go and moving forward. And we'll pick it up there next week. But for now, if you're here in the room, I'd love to invite you to stand, and I'll close our time in prayer. And once again today, we'll have a few friends under the screen to the left if you'd like to pray with someone before you leave. But let me close our time. Heavenly Father, we celebrate you. We celebrate your goodness to us. And we confess, we're quick to forget the blessings that you have provided, and we're quick to obsess about that which we do not have. And so I pray that you give us clarity as we take a look at the condition of our hearts this week. May gratitude rise, may jealousy fall. In the end, we desire to let go of what we need to let go of and to move forward into the full color, rich life you have designed for us to live. And so we thank you for that invitation. We thank you for that opportunity. Most of all, we thank you for Jesus. It is in his name, the name above all names, that we pray. And everyone said, amen. Grace and peace, friends. We'll see you next week.